I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 208 of CaroPop. If you'd like to support us and keep this thing going, please go to caropop.com. Our guests this week were the production team behind one of rock's greatest debut albums, Mitch Easter and Don Dixon, who co-produced REM's Murmur. Interscope Capital recently released a definitive sound series vinyl edition of Murmur, coupled with REM's preceding EP, Chronic Town, also produced by Easter. This all-analog one-step is limited to 3,000 numbered copies, retails for $125, and has received raves in the audiophile world. So this felt like an excellent occasion to reunite Easter and Dixon to talk with them about their experiences making the 1983 album Murmur, as well as REM's follow-up, Reckoning, which the pair also co-produced. We get into Chronic Town as well. As you may have noticed in previous CaroPop episodes featuring REM bassist Mike Mills, REM contributing musicians Scott McCoy and Peter Holsapple, Fables of the Reconstruction producer Joe Boyd, and earlier conversations with Easter and Dixon, I'm a major REM fan and have been for quite some time. In fact, the first time I saw them was when I was in college in Philadelphia in the fall of 1983, and REM played on campus with Easter's band Let's Active as one of the openers. Perfect circle of acquaintances and friends. I became a Let's Active fan from that moment on as well. But even with my deep, decades-long REM immersion, there are parts of this conversation with Easter and Dixon that I found revelatory. I'll let you discover them for yourselves. But if you enjoy, say, Radio Free Europe and Perfect Circle, you won't want to miss the stories of their recording. Why was Dixon brought in to produce Murmur with Easter? What did each of them bring to the process? What was REM like in the studio versus how they were as a live band? What had changed by the time REM recorded Reckoning? Did Easter and Dixon ever think this early REM work would be getting such high-end treatment more than 40 years after its release? Why does one of them consider Murmur to be the dark side of the moon of the new wave era? We also discuss Easter's recent reunion with half of REM, Mills and guitarist Peter Buck, when he produced the Baseball Project's latest album, Grand Salami Time, in his North Carolina studio. What was it like to work with them again? Easter also played a recent concert of Let's Active material in North Carolina. Is there more to come? Dixon, meanwhile, has kept a low profile in rural Ohio, yet keeps producing excellent work too, including Holsapple's album from last year, The Face of 68. I've loved talking with these guys individually, and as REM learned, when you get them together, you wind up with something even better. Dixon, by the way, is the one with the deeper voice. Please enjoy this CaroPop conversation with Mitch Easter and Don Dixon. Congrats on that Let's Active theme show you just did. That looked like it was fantastic. I wished I could have flown out for that.
I mean, you should have. It was really great. We had this super happy audience, you know. I think it just happened at the right time for people to want to hear that stuff. You know, it was great.
Well, you just have to bring it to Chicago because, you know, we would all come out and see it here too. So,
would you?
Absolutely. I'll bang the drum. I'll get everyone I know to come. So,
well, I think we need to have like a promoter want to do this as well. But yeah, we'd do it. I mean, I think if I can get everybody, you know, to do it, it's a little more difficult when your band has all these grown-ups in it, you know, they have these grown-up things they have to do. But,
yeah. Yeah. Grown-ups suck.
But then the glamour of it all, you know, that pulls them away from their obligations, I think.
It's great to get you guys together for this. I really appreciate it. When you were recording this stuff, did you ever think, oh yeah, these two records are going to be coupled as a $125 audiophile product?
I wish we'd gotten $125 to make them.
Yeah, I mean, I wish I had a prepared story about a vision I had, you know, of all this, but
someday, no. Yeah. Someday they're going to be this and Dark Side of the Moon. And, mm-hmm. You know, they're going to be the ones that they test out in record store, audio, you know, equipment stores, if they still have.
Okay. Well, I will say that I have been saying, and I think Dixon can back me up on this, that for many years now, I've been saying that Murmur was the Dark Side of the Moon of the new wave era because he keeps selling. So that's sort of prescient, you know, vaguely. I mean, I was joking, but it's kind of true.
It's also a great sounding record. I mean, there is nothing like I've been cranking it up all weekend. And this morning I was telling Don that I woke my kid up with it. You don't get to sleep in when I have to, you know, listen to Murmur very loud, but it sounds fantastic. Like there's so many records from 1983 that sound like 1983, and Murmur sounds like you could, you know, listen to it anytime. It could have been recorded anytime.
I agree. I'll think of it more as a 1967 record myself, but, you know, just in terms of its sonics.
I hear it more as 73, but, you know, but yeah, definitely not 83. And I mean, I don't think that was exactly by design, but it wasn't undeliberate either. I mean, you know, what I like is that I really think the sound of it was just guided by being there in that place with those songs and this sounds good. And then just doing that without referring back to anything else. And that made it sort of just its own thing, I guess.
We did go into it knowing it needed to be kind of bass drum heavy and have that sort of dance beat feel to the whole thing to sort of lock it in sonically to something that would sound good on the radio. And a lot of what we were just trying to do is make this modern sort of thing that wasn't like the things that were currently on the radios. Be loud on the radio. So,
well, like Radio Free Europe, it sounds like there was sort of a different approach maybe to that than the rest of the record in terms of, all right, this is the lead single, this is the kickoff track, and it's got a little bit more of a, I don't know if modern's the right word, but it seems like it's produced a little more with radio in mind than the rest of it.
I don't know. It's just a very straightforward song. So that makes it kind of like that kind of song also, you know. I mean, it's not the kind of song that it would benefit from too much frippery, you know. It's kind of straight ahead, but you know, it was just.
And they'd also recorded it. Y'all had done it. They'd done it like that was the third time they'd done a record of it, right?
Yeah, but I mean, for me personally, I'm not very strategic about anything. I just can't be, you know. It seems kind of. I mean, some songs are obviously going to be more popular, or catchy, or whatever. But I can't imagine. Like, I just don't really know what you do to make it radio friendly other than sound good, you know, in some way, but that changes all the time.
I guess I was thinking for Radio Free Europe, maybe the drum sound on it's a little different. It's a little more, I don't even know how I would describe it, but a little more snare-y or something than.
Yeah. Well, there's a reason for that, which I think Don Dixon might want to explain.
Well, I can't remember which technique we used for that. Was it the spray can? What was it?
No, on the recording there at Reflection, the thing we did that's kind of, you know, maybe a dark secret, but I've never not said this before, but we overdubbed a snare on top of the one that Bill played because, you know, Bill liked recording in that drum booth that they had there, which was kind of great and sort of an odd thing to do in those years. Those drum booths had gone out of fashion, but he wanted to work in there, and it was great in a lot of ways. But on that song, we didn't get a very separated kind of snare that would really pop, you know. So actually I played a snare on top of what was there, and Dixon punched me in whenever I got off, and we recorded it with the microphone kind of at some distance and a bunch of compression and stuff, so it's got that sort of quasi unreal sound that was coming into fashion, you know. You heard stuff like that on that Peter Gabriel record, you know, that doesn't have any cymbals on it, you know. They really made a thing. They're acoustic drums, but they're recording them in these different ways that sounded cool, you know. They're kind of unreal, you know. So that was the only song on Murmur that has that snare overdub.
Wow. See, so when I said it was more snare-y, I was like totally on target.
That's true. It is. But I don't think we did it to get on the radio. I think we just thought the snare needs some help, you know. It was just
interesting.
More, you know what I mean? But yeah, maybe it was a good thing to do. I mean, I think it was, because the snare just wasn't quite, we couldn't get it to sit because there was so much hi-hat in the snare signal.
And you're the one playing it.
Yeah. Because we were the guys in the studio. I don't know where they were. You know, it's like, we need to do this. So we just did it.
And they were fine with it, I assume.
They never knew.
They never knew. This is the first, if they listen to this, they're going to be like, wait, Mitch did that? What?
Yeah. I don't think we said, hey guys, check out what we did, you know, because we just did.
That you never win when you do that. You only win by keeping your mouth shut.
That's funny. So the chronology is that there was the Radio Free Europe Sitting Still Hip Tone single, and then there was Chronic Town, which was recorded at the drive-in, and Don was not, that was Mitch, and then the two of you teamed up and did Murmur in another studio. What was the progression of the band sort of working in the studio in these different incarnations? Were they sort of evolving as studio musicians on top of, you know, how they were as a band just playing live and doing their songs?
Do you want to take that, Don?
Well, I think they obviously got better at understanding what it takes to make a record instead of just standing in front of 15 of your friends and playing loud. You just do. I mean, they were doing it a lot. They were playing a lot, but they weren't like a session band by any stretch of the imagination. They were a band, and that's what makes them good. I mean, if they had been session guys, they wouldn't have been doing the songs. They wouldn't have written these songs to begin with, and they wouldn't have been this kind of band, you know? So the last thing we wanted them to be was session guys. We just thought they were a cool band.
They tended to play live in the studio, I would assume.
Yes. Yeah. Everything starts live, yes.
I'm sure there are a lot of people working in real different ways, but for Don and I, we both always just thought that, for Don and me, we thought that we respected the band thing. You know, we liked that, you know. I mean, already there was a lot of sort of negative attitudes about the stuff that was actually really selling, you know, and the band were sort of like that too. They were REM, I mean, they were sort of grumpy about their time in some ways. I mean, they knew what they liked about it and what they didn't like. And they definitely didn't want to make what was seen at the time as an industry record, you know? They were very individualistic in their heads, and they wanted to not lose that. And the studios got fancier just due to their circumstances, you know? By the time Murmur was made, they were signed to IRS, and IRS wanted to sell records, so they wanted them to be in what was clearly a really good studio.
Right.
And so that just happened kind of naturally, you know, it seemed like the thing to do.
We had to audition essentially for that record anyway. I mean, they went to a lot of different studios or several different places and recorded a few songs with other producers before.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say, they had some other producer lined up for Murmur, and then they're like, no, this isn't what we want.
I don't think anything was lined up, but the label had some people they wanted them to work with, you know. There were a couple of names I can remember, but I don't think it got too far because the band, like I say, they were always very assertive about what they would and would not do. You know, they didn't have that attitude that some bands do have. We're like, this is our shot. We got to do whatever they want us to do. They wouldn't do that, you know. So they didn't like what they had done with these other people, I guess, you know.
So how did you guys get the gig? Did they just say, hey, we want these two, or like what was the process there?
We recorded a couple of songs with them.
Yeah, we're also really lovable, you know, and they just saw that. I mean, you know, they had worked with me on Chronic Town, and they knew I wasn't going to mess with them in that way that creeped them out, you know. And then I was when we went to Reflection, it's because, you know, IRS said we had to record on 24 tracks, which still amuses me, you know. And so we did. I really wanted Don to work on that with me because I'd never worked at Reflection, really. But then, you know, we did the song Pilgrimage, and everybody was really happy with it. Except the label, but you know, the band just insisted, and that's what happened.
The label wasn't happy with Pilgrimage.
No, they weren't impressed.
Like the recording that's on Murmur, they were not happy.
Yeah, yeah, they weren't. I don't know why.
I was listening to it again just now, as I mentioned, you know, really loud. And I've always kind of felt like Pilgrimage is sort of the cornerstone. I don't know what it is. It's like a key. I mean, there are a lot of key tracks on that record, but Pilgrimage is the one where everything kind of flowers and opens up in a way that it's like, this is taking them somewhere I hadn't heard them at that point.
I agree. I love that song, and I love the way it sounds. And we did it all in one day, and we didn't ever remix it or anything.
That was our audition, essentially. But it's Pilgrimage. What you hear on the record.
Wow.
Yeah, it was the audition tape. And I love that we lost the audition, but then won the record. Or, you know, I mean, it was just funny.
So wait, they went to someone else after you did Pilgrimage?
No, they didn't. I think they just refused, you know. I think they said, no, this is what we're doing. And somehow they were able to get their way.
And they loved it too. I mean, they liked the way it turned out. I was fantastically happy about the way it turned out. And, you know, and it's contrary to anything anybody would want to have happened or believed, that Peter's playing his guitar through a Casino 10-inch transistor amplifier.
Yep.
With a 10-inch speaker.
That's a fact. And it's the only song on the record with the Casino. So maybe that's what makes it the cornerstone. I don't know. That Casino just sounded perfect on that song.
It really was. For his style, it was great.
This is only because his amp was broken, you know, and so right. The studio had that amp, so we used it.
I was doing this thing for a while when I had all these friends having these landmark birthdays, and I would make them like a mix CD of like one song from every year they'd been alive. So if they were turning 50 in 2014, you know, they would just get one song from each year. And for 83, often like I put Pilgrimage on there. That was like the one I would put there. So,
well, thank you. I'm honored. I think that is one of the best ideas I've ever heard in my life. I'm going to steal that idea.
Oh, it's great. It's great. I honestly, this makes me an old person, but I had more trouble. I had more trouble later because I didn't have like CD, like the CD burner, like went away from the laptop. So right. It became harder. And yeah. Also making the distinction between the song for 2021 or 22, and I don't have them on CDs anymore. But those were fun. I would make them for like all my friends, and it was fun for me just to do it. And then I'd listen to them. So how did you guys know each other originally, by the way?
The rock scene, you know, the ancient rock scene of North Carolina. Our bands cross paths, things like that.
Like Arrogance and what, Sneakers or what?
No, I was in a band called Sacred Irony.
Sacred Irony.
Yeah.
They were fantastic. And Mitch was fantastic. I still remember the first time I ever saw him play. He was 15, I think. And he had the best haircut
and likewise Arrogance was incredibly impressive to me. You know, they had great singing and they were really powerful and had this sort of half Sabbath, half Procol Harum thing going on at the time. That was awesome. That's the word really fit.
We were a good band. We were two really good bands. And it's amazing that Winston-Salem scene just, you know, it actually, because there were places to play, I think, had a lot to do with why there were so many great bands out of there.
That's right. I mean, I don't know which the first time I saw it was, either at the Ancient Armory, which must have been built in 1812.
That's right.
Okay, so that was probably the first time. And then I saw you at the Starlight Swim Club, which is another fantastic sudden rock venue. Everything was a rock venue for about 10 minutes there, which was great, you know.
So how did you get from, you know, seeing each other at each other's shows to, you know, working in studios and then eventually working in studios together?
Yeah, we weren't like great buddies early on, but once Mitch moved to Chapel Hill, we got to be a lot more friends. And then once he built the studio and built Drive-In, you know, we worked together a lot. So I worked at Drive-In a lot and I'd love to.
You also were a studio veteran. I mean, you've been playing on real sessions since you were a kid.
I did start playing on sessions when I was 15 in real studios and stuff. And Arrogance, you know, made a lot of records and recorded in a lot of places. And so Mitch now has recorded many more exotic and fantastic places than I have. But at the time, I had more experience because I'm a lot older. I'm nearing my 90s.
Listener, this is not true.
Close. But I was an entire kind of high school generation older. So like I was a freshman in college when I met Mitch, he was a freshman in high school. So,
and you each independently were drawn to, you know, doing the kind of studio engineering production work, as opposed to just continuing playing in bands and not doing that.
I mean, I just really liked records. I loved recorded sound. You know, and I didn't know how it was done for a long time. You couldn't read about it. You know, it was great that you couldn't in a lot of ways because it kept it, you know, magic. But more and more, I understood what was going on. I just thought about it a lot, you know, and I thought, I want to do that. You know, it's like playing live is really good, but I love what you can do with recording. You can just do more, you know, and you can come back to it and tweak it and all that kind of stuff. And I mean, I'm, by modern standards, I'm like a field recordist, you know, I don't like taking forever to do stuff, but I did really like studio recordings a lot. And I just wanted to do that. I mean, my dad came home with a tape recorder in 1962 at Christmas or 63. And that was one of the forks in the road for me. It's like, I just love that thing. I just could not stop recording stuff, you know? So, you know, I just kept doing that.
And that was similar for me when I was a kid. I bought a tape recorder off our doctor that lived next door, you know, when he got a new one in the early 60s. And just, you know, even though in my grown-up life have said recording has ruined music, I actually also loved it and grew up doing that. I mean, I took a summer job out in California when I was still in high school just so I could save up money to buy a Panasonic sound tape recorder in 1968. And then when the TX came out, you know, we all, Mitch and Chris and I all got these TX four-track machines because it was the first time you could really make kind of interesting, fairly high quality recordings at home that you had a little control over.
Yeah.
So when you two are, you know, working in studios and working together, like what are the areas where the two of you are just like totally in sync, like you have the same approach, and what are the areas where, you know, you're different and complement each other? Like one of you will bring sort of one thing and one of you will bring the other thing and you'll bounce this sort of thing off each other.
I mean, I would like to say that, you know, I'm the blues guy and Dixon is the prog guy, but there's nothing like that to it. I mean, when we work together, we just, I don't know who does what. I mean, at Reflection, I'm sure he did more engineering than I did because he'd worked there already and stuff, but it was not a division of labor kind of thing so much, you know?
No, I mean, we're both musicians and, you know, Mitch is incredibly talented. Maybe my favorite guitar player in the whole world. And, you know, I'm a journeyman able to sort of slog through things that need to be done kind of musician. And we sort of had different, like I grew up listening to a lot of jazz and playing a lot of jazz and singing R&B and stuff like that. And Mitch grew up with more like, I don't know, Small Faces and who else? What would be a good band, good example for what you loved when you...
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the stuff that really turned me on was just a little bit later, you know, and so I got my first jazz record when I was, you know, 30 or something, you know what I mean? I just knew the radio, you know, in the 60s, you know, so that was, you know, but the rock radio, you know, I remember, you know, really liking, you know, The Who and The Zombies and these English bands a lot, but also like Burt Bacharach, that kind of American sort of, you know, lifestyle pop that had cool chords in it. I love that, you know, but.
Jimmy Webb, probably, right.
I love Jimmy Webb hits, you know, I did like stuff with those chords, those modern chords, those mid-century comfortable and interesting chords a lot. But, you know, the history of that going back, you know, because those are jazz guys, or Burt Bacharach is anyway, you know, going back to what they came from, I didn't know any of that, you know. So relative to your music knowledge in the early days, I think I was the kid for sure.
I seem to remember that you and Peter Hulsapple, it seemed like there was this whole wave of people who loved Shazam by the Move in North Carolina.
Yes.
Who doesn't love that record? Anybody who doesn't love that record needs to be put on the rack.
Yeah, they're wrong.
Exactly. Tell the guys at DSS that's their next thing, Shazam by the Move.
Oh, man. I'd be all over that.
That would be great. Roy has kind of been like just written out of history, hadn't he?
I mean, somewhat.
There's a cult around him, though. There are a lot of people who are still like, that's the thing. So is one of you more kind of techie gear expert, or, you know, one of you more like experimental, let's try these loops or sound effects? Are you guys both like doing the same sort of thing?
Just both of those people, and I'm the guy sitting in the corner going, that sounds pretty good.
Oh, yeah. Give me a break. But
Mitch,
I mean,
Mitch is very experimental and great ideas and, you know, knows a lot more about the technical side of thing, I think, than I do, even though we both have some expertise in that area just because of the massive number of hours we've spent doing this.
Well, I do remember that when I bought that Quantum console from you way back, you know, you told me it had some particular aspect of the circuitry of the mic preamp that was good, and I was kind of like, oh really? I mean, you know, I didn't know anything, but I mean,
they were good mic, those were cool mic preamps. It was that one chip they were using,
right? See, right. I still don't know about that one chip, but I mean, I'll take your word for it.
We're just both practical about it. We if there's noise coming out and we think it sounds okay, then we hit the record button. It's not, we're not ADHD about this stuff at all.
And I mean, that sounds sort of like you're joking, but it's the truth. You know, it's like, I think what we keep in mind is that this is pop music and what we're after is interesting sounds. You know, we're not interested in specifications, right? So, you know, that's why there is all this sort of lore around broken guitar amps on legendary solos and stuff, because it's kind of true. It gets exaggerated, of course, because people exaggerate everything, but this sort of accidental, oh, wow, how did that happen? We have no idea. It sounds great. Hit record is kind of what keeps you interested sometimes, you know, and it makes for more interesting records. And I think we agree on that. And I think that's one reason why it's easy for us to work together, you know.
Well, Murmur's interesting in that it's this very straightforward, hard-hitting record, but there are these like experimental things on it, but they're not like, you know, like whipping your head around and making you think, oh my God, that's so experimental. But you're like, wait, what's that? What's that sound on We Walk? It's pool balls. What's that thing at the beginning of Radio Free Europe? What's happening, you know, in the middle eight of that song? You know, like there are odd little touches on there that sort of come in that you would think, you know, when they were playing the song live beforehand, they wouldn't have been doing that.
They did, yeah. They did do that. Most of those intros we did sort of help, just felt like it needed some sort of more interesting transitional element, you know.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Some people are irritated by stuff that they don't quite get, you know. And like I did records with Game Theory, and some people didn't take to them because their moments like that were a little more ta-da, you know. But I think the stealth version that might be on Murmur a bit is sort of the best because it doesn't upset anybody. And the people that like stuff like that can go, oh, that's cool. And what is that? And, you know, think about it. I mean, you know, like nobody ever thinks that Here Comes the Sun, you know, by the Beatles has all these weird time signatures in it, or Happiness is the Warm Gun. You know, they just don't think about that, but they're there, but they're natural feeling, you know, so that's even better, really.
But then Here Comes the Sun has all that early Moog synthesizer on it.
Right. And I bet to this day, most people think, oh, there aren't any synths on Beatles records, you know, but it's all over that record, you know?
Yeah.
So that's cool. It's kind of a testament to what they did with it though, you know, because it certainly was not because what people still, maybe this batch of people are dying, but people will still, there's always the one thing people will talk about, you know, it's kind of like Cher with autotune and oh, what a lucky man with the Moog synthesizer, you know, because of that sort of in your face synth solo, which is actually great. But, you know, anyway, yeah, I love it when it can work on both levels. It's sort of like Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons, right? They're great for the adults and they're great for the kids, you know? I mean, I love the super chopped up, super, like SF Sorrow or something is one of these, like, check out these techniques we're doing, you know, I like that, but not everybody does. And for REM has this kind of earthy quality about them all the time, you know? So if you're going to do the funny stuff, it needs to be a little more, you know, like it's a spontaneous mutation as opposed to a clever idea, I think. Does that make sense?
So would those sort of stealth experiments come from you guys as opposed to, I don't know, Peter Buck saying, you know, we need something weird here?
They never wanted anything weird. They were just playing their songs. And we were doing these records really fast, and nobody had time to think a lot.
Exactly. There weren't too many focus groups, and there weren't any meetings, and it was just bam, 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 you know, but in the best kind of way.
Right. Exactly.
Long enough to make that record the way it should have been made, because it's perfect, right? I mean, I don't think either of us wishes that we had three more weeks on that. We just don't.
I was ready to go home after maybe 3 days before it ended.
Well, was there any band resistance to anything you tried to do with one of the songs? And they're like, no, this is too much.
Yeah, they threw stuff out. Yeah, we tried things that they didn't like.
Like what?
I don't know. I had some vocals stuff I had them try, I think, one time that they despised, but they tried it.
Do you remember on what song?
No. Do you, Mitch?
The vocal thing, I don't remember, but of course, Perfect Circle had a strong pushback, but somehow we prevailed, you know. Because, you know, that was a song that was really kind of made in the studio. They played it before that with just a keyboard, you know, it's a little Casio and vocals. They wanted to do a band version, but how do you do a band version of that song, you know? So in that case, I think we did more than they did in some ways to put it together. And I think that was maybe off-putting, but...
You mean the terms of the arrangement of that song?
Yeah, everything about it. The instruments aren't arranged.
Mitch played, what'd you play?
I played the backwards guitar, we made a loop out of some drums that we found that Bill had already played or something. You know, we really put that one together. It might have been like a day off. We just went in there and did that or something. I don't even know now. But
well,
there was I mean, Bill had the great comment. It was like, "You're kidding, right?" Which I love that, you know. But but it's like, no, we're not kidding. We think this is good, you know. And somehow, I guess they.
Well, I think maybe Mike Mills played piano, though, right? Mills played
piano. Well, Bill and Mike played piano together.
At the same time, that's right.
And I think that's all we had, you know. And the click track was the drum loop we made because we knew we were going to be overdubbing to it and stuff, and that'd make it easier. But then I think they weren't there after that for a long time, and then that's when it went crazy.
So is the whole drum track on that just a drum loop?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that's back when a loop was a real loop, like reciting.
We mean a piece of tape. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I get that. That one was one that I'd always heard that Bill had written. And I don't know if, like, how much you sort of got under the hood of, like, sort of who was writing what. But is that right that was sort of a Bill song? So he would have been maybe more in charge of how it sounded?
He made up the piano part, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's right.
Wrote it.
I mean, then Michael Stipe would put the lyrics and melody over the top of whatever the bed that other people had come up with.
Just like Black Oak, Arkansas.
Did you see any of that process in work, or was it really like they came into the studio and these were the songs and that's what you recorded?
They had the songs.
I think there were probably instances where nobody really knew quite yet what Michael was singing.
Right.
Saying, but none of us cared. You know, really. And he would bring in like little scraps of paper that he would be working on. So,
I did this interview with them for the liner notes for this reissue of Chronic Town when it was, you know, in its 80th year of release or whatever. And it was interesting talking to those guys because they all in their own ways sort of said that they were pretty deliberate about it. Once they realized that their band was kind of a thing, they kind of worked and they threw out a lot of stuff, you know, and by the time they had a song that they considered an REM song, they had knocked it around a fair bit. And so that's kind of how it was with Murmur. They had a batch of songs, you know.
And they were, I mean, and Bill was maybe the best sort of bullshit meter of all of them, you know. And
yeah.
He was great about that aspect of things, almost everything. But yeah, the songs were, they weren't democratic. They were more like a four rats in a cage, you know, in terms of that thing. Just working out what the conditions were going to be and what they were going to accept as an REM song, like Mitch said, as opposed to somebody else's song, especially early on.
Yeah. I think once it was an REM song though, then there was total respect for it. You know, they were always on board with what they were doing. I mean, it was interesting because they were all quite different personalities, but they had this, I just keep coming back to the word respect, you know, it's like, they listen to each other. You know, I don't recall any of them saying, "Well, you're stupid." You know, I mean, which a lot of bands would do like all the time, you know, and they just didn't.
Exactly. There was never any of that kind of stuff. They'd fight for something they believed in, but it was always in a respectful way. And I think that's why they still are business partners. You know?
Yeah.
Mitch and I noticed early on that they had these distinct personalities, very much like the Beatles had these distinct personalities that, you know, were portrayed in the cartoon show. I mean, you could have so easily made an REM cartoon with these very...
I mean, I guess it's never too late, I guess.
Right. All right, so what are the cartoon personalities of REM?
Well, I mean, it's not so much that they... I'm not going to try to define it like you do in the Hard Day's Night movie, but they just were distinct. I mean, they were really clearly... had these roles that I think the fans, I mean, early on, they weren't big at all. They would still have girls like hanging out outside the door and stuff. It was weird. Don't you think, Mitch?
Yeah, I think the people showed up really on the Reckoning session, not so much the Murmur session. They had a couple of actual friends in Charlotte that came by, you know. But, I mean, they were super, but they did become popular real fast wherever they played live. And that's just because they exuded that thing, you know. Which is undefinable, but crucial.
And I'm going to point out something that I've never really thought about until right now. Bands with a lead singer almost never have that.
Really?
Yeah, because bands with a lead singer, the lead singer gets like 80% of the weight.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's true. That didn't happen. I mean, Michael certainly has a lot of weight in that band, but it was much more balanced, as if he was also playing guitar, sort of.
Right. And he always sort of emphasized that he wanted his voice to be considered like an equal instrument with the other instruments, as opposed to, like, it wasn't until the later records that his voice was even kind of pushed forward, right?
I don't know. It's just like, you know, I think those vocals are loud as fuck, but that's just my opinion.
I always wondered about the super audible, not too many words, nobody can mistake a word I'm saying kind of thing that happened, you know, around the time of Orange Crush and stuff like that. And I always wondered, is it like him throwing, I am so tired of people saying they can't tell what I'm saying and they think I'm not saying anything, so I'll show you. You know, I don't know if there was any of that or not, because, I mean, you know, I'll say it again, you know, those songs do have words, and we sure. all saw them typed out on the Reflection typewriter, which he loved using. And I never had any trouble understanding them. And as far as what they mean, that's another story. But, you know, that was always a weird thing.
Right.
But I always thought that was kind of this weird, like, cultural trope that came up around them. Like, Michael's really inaudible and he's not even saying real words. I mean, I can see that a little more for the Cocteau Twins, right? But not Michael, you know?
Right. Well, they called the album Murmur, too. So when you call it Murmur, you're almost asking for people to think, well, you're not really enunciating, but or you're doing it very softly or something.
Well, I mean, I will say, I mean, yeah, I think it's true. He didn't want to be like, ta-da, here I am, the star guy, you know?
For Murmur, did they come in with those 12 songs that became the album?
I think so.
Yeah, I mean, I don't recall having a conversation about throwing something out or which song they were going to do. I think they sort of said, I think we like these. I mean, they were happy. They had, I mean, what, like you said, Perfect Circle was sort of on the bubble, I'm guessing.
Well, I mean, you know, there were actual, you know, like if somebody was going to make the outtakes record of Murmur, there wouldn't be one except for just, you know, scraps or something, you know, right. Because but like on Chronic Town, there actually were some songs that were sort of left behind because they just weren't happening. Like that 9 to 9 song that's on Murmur. I don't think to this day they all understood where the one was in the same place on that song. It's a really weird song, you know, and there's a Chronic Town outtake that's pretty cool where they kind of play the whole thing, but they are, it's like, what is happening here, you know? And it's and they just gave up on it, you know? So, I mean, that record actually has some proper outtakes, but I don't think Murmur does.
Ages of You they did for Chronic Town?
No, I don't think so. There's something, you know, a Murmur that is actually older that was recorded up in my garage, but and I forget why that was. I know, well, it was the song that they recorded again for Murmur, but they ended up not liking the Murmur version.
Yeah,
those Sitting Still.
Yes.
Yeah, sitting, and I totally forgot about that until the Atmos mix was done and they couldn't find the multi-track to it because I had it. So, yeah, but anyway, yeah, but about the songs from Murmur, I think those were the songs from Murmur, you know, and that's what we did. I guess if some of them had failed, they might have had some ready to go, but I don't remember talking about that.
I did think I read that Ages of You was originally on the list for Chronic Town and IRS rejected it or something.
Well, the thing about that is Chronic Town was recorded before they were signed. Like IRS put it out, but it was completed before they signed the deal, actually.
So they didn't like veto, say, oh, you know, you're turning in this record, but I want you to like leave off Ages of You and start with Wolves Lower or anything like that.
No. Not coming from a label. No, just it would be their own decision.
How are those records sequenced, by the way? Was that the band? Was that you guys?
I think Don Dixon has a lot to do with sequencing. He's good at it and he could tell you more.
And I think I did most of Murmur, but, or at least made the suggestion that we ended up with. We used to sequence by making these little short snippets that had the beginning and the end of the song, at least I did, just like a 30-second version of the song so I could get a feel quickly of how they actually flowed together. And I think I sequenced Murmur, and I remember laying on the floor out there in the studio and listening to the whole thing.
And I think for Murmur, though, it was the whole song. I think we really wanted to experience the full, you know, 40 minutes or whatever.
Oh, sure. Ultimately. Yeah. But to just kind of get it, the feel, I would make these little short versions.
Yeah.
Do you have like a philosophy of sequencing on like how a record should start and end, and you know, the four corners or anything like that?
I just sort of base it all on, you know, good American Beatle records. You know, like the American version of Rubber Soul is one of the best sequence records that's ever existed. And people that say that the American Rubber Soul, you know, is butchery or just dumb.
I love the American Rubber Soul because I've just seen A Face and It's Only Love, which are on side B of the British Help, are like two great album side openers.
And no, I mean, it's a beautifully sequenced record. So I would go back to that a lot when I was trying to figure out how to make sequences work.
There are all these, you know, vinyl record artifact things that help sequencing be a thing, I think, too. You know what I mean? You had to think about the opener track on each side, and sometimes you would think about the fact that the last song on the side kind of didn't sound quite as good and things like that. And then, of course, IRS demanded that what they saw as a single be the first song. That was their policy for years. So there was that, too. But mainly, you know, it's kind of feel, and hopefully when you get a good sequence, you feel it and you know you're kind of right.
Yeah. And there are little things like if a song is three beats slower than the song before it, you know, then it seemed wrong. You know, it's like,
yeah,
you can't have things slow down until they really slow down.
Right. It needs to be more of an abrupt, like we're changing genres here, not like, oh, we're losing momentum slowly.
Exactly. If you're something just a little bit slower than the song before it, it really hurts that song that's after it. Keys can matter.
No, the keys. I've been curious about keys, like whether you sort of like make a point of not putting a song in the same key after, you know, another one.
Sometimes I like to keep a modal thing going and a key thing going for a while, and because it gives you this sense of continuity. But it's also can get boring. So.
Yeah, exactly. But then there's these things that are just so wrong that they're right. Or who knows, maybe you've heard it so much and you just like the record anyway. And one of my favorites is, you know, because in the old days, rock bands especially, were not tuning up to any kind of tuning devices, you know. So A is not the same as A on the next song. And an awesome example of that is Led Zeppelin 2, where Heartbreaker goes into Livin' Lovin' Made. And they're both in A, but Livin' Lovin' Made is really flat to Heartbreaker, and everything about that is wrong, but it's great. It's great. It works, you know.
Now, what about for Reckoning then? I think I saw something recently, Don, where it was saying that you were not happy with the sequence of Reckoning.
Well, they rejected my sequence. That's all. It wasn't that I wasn't happy. It's like I tried a sequence, and I think Mike Mills ended up sort of at least telling me they were going to change some stuff. But they changed a few things. But I think the sequence Reckoning is great now. I mean, just I don't even remember what mine was.
Oh, come on. What was your sequence? I want to know.
I truly don't remember. I mean, and I'm sure there's no record of it anywhere. It's just, you know, just sitting in the studio goofing around trying to get the thing finished.
Did it still start with Harbor Coat?
I would have a lot of trouble telling you what songs are on that record. So it's like, I mean, it all just turns into one big thing when you recorded 10,000 songs. It's really hard to remember. That was a long time ago, buddy.
Nah, I know, but you know, but it's fresh in my mind, so it should be fresh in your mind. You made it. Mitch is sort of keeping quiet on this part of it.
I don't remember the sequencing wars and alternate sequences very well at all, so I just don't.
Well, it didn't start with the single though, because the single was the third song.
Yeah, that is curious, and I was thinking about that when you were talking about that record, because I don't know if they just defied the authorities, or maybe they had a different idea about what the single would be, or maybe they just thought, we don't hear a single, you know? So then the band just did what they did. I don't remember that, yeah.
I do have a theory that I like to make the single the third song on the side A. So maybe that survived on that record.
Now, I have a lot of old records where the single is the last thing on side A, and that must have just been like, bait to make you turn it over and play the other side, you know, which is weird, you know, because you can pretty, if you think about it, you can tell that the last song on an LP doesn't sound as good, you know, but it didn't really matter to the audience. I guess that was the assumption because they were children, you know.
REM tended to put the kind of moody song at the end of side one, Perfect Circle, Time After Time, Old Man Kenzie. It's first three records, at least.
Yeah. Softer songs sound are less, it's less obvious. Things with less bass and that aren't quite as bombastic, the inner groove distortion is less of a problem.
Right.
That's part of why you would do that.
I guess the counterexample is Abbey Road, right? Because you're ending side one with that cacophony of I Want You, She's So Heavy, and side two ends with a big medley, the big rock, you know, trading off all the guitar solos and stuff.
Yeah. That's because laws of physics don't apply to the Beatles. You know? they just don't, so you know, they can do that.
Was your experience in recording Reckoning similar to recording Murmur?
It was different.
Yeah, it was different. They had just come off that tour with the Police, and they were, I think they were, maybe, and Michael wasn't real well when we were making that record. He was, I don't know, I mean, it wasn't anything serious, but it was just like, you know, he had a cold or something. There was just, I think there was just, they weren't quite as excited because it was, they were having to go in and make another, fulfill a contract sort of. There was that element, I think, to it, maybe. I don't know.
They had been so much busier before that record, you know, and you could tell because they had a new van, you know, and things were moving fast, you know.
they didn't have to share one motel room like they did when we made Murmur. They all stayed.
It wasn't like the Beatles and Help anymore, where they're all like on the couch together and stuff.
No, I don't think it was.
Yeah. But I can't imagine staying in one motel room. I guess Arrogance did that a few times, but not while we were making records.
I mean, REM even stayed at that crime scene room at the Milestone, if you can believe that, you know, sleeping on the concrete floor. So, I mean, they really did the thing before they hit the big time.
So creatively, did Reckoning feel a little less energetic also?
I thought it was very energetic, but it wasn't as deep or something to me, you know. It was more like rock band, you know. Well, they still really, really good songs, but, you know.
Yeah. I mean, they came in, one of the things that Bill did say to me and Mike Mills was that we want more of a rock band drum sound on this one. And Mitch and I put them out in the room to play drums instead of in the booth. I think they wanted to go, and Mike Mills definitely wanted more of a rock band bass sound. So we built kind of a fancy tunnel bass recording for him where I had mics at several different spots and we could just make it a more energetic, complicated bass sound. So they had things they wanted to try. I think playing in those Coliseums, especially for Mike and Bill, affected what they wanted the band to sound like.
How about Peter? Was he like the same as always?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, I mean, Peter's just sort of
the man in the band. You know,
he's the what?
The old man in the band.
Oh yeah, because he's the oldest one by, you know, 6 months or something. Yeah, right. You're right. But his attitude is definitely not like he's interested in any fuss. You know, if he hears the sound and it's okay, he goes with it. You know, he doesn't like to think it through. He just knows if he likes it or not. We did do a few different things with recording the guitar technically, but, you know, yeah, I mean, it was still a very straightforward record. I think it took two more days longer than Murmur. They're almost identical lengths of time. Both of them are fast.
Yeah. Peter was like a guy, he's like you wind him up and he played these incredible guitar parts. Really underrated guitar player as far as I'm concerned.
Well, he could sort of do what he does and I don't know who else could do it. Like it was like, if you're like, oh, give me like a shredding guitar solo, that's not what you go to Peter Buck for. But like, no. I mean, even something like Wolves Lower, it's like,
that sort of unsexy type of guitar player is not understood, I think, by a lot of people. Whereas just in terms of his stage presence, though, he was just incredible. I was just going to say the Guitar Player magazine doesn't understand it. I don't think.
So is DSS going to do a Reckoning also?
I don't know.
I think it'll depend on if these sell.
How involved were you in this project?
Not at all.
We were told it was going to happen.
Yeah.
Did you get copies and play them on your turntables and hear differences?
Oh yeah, they were interested in us hearing it, and yes, you could hear the hell out of the differences. Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. You know, I'm not a huge vinyl guy, but these sound very good.
Yeah, the thing that's important to say is they're not meant to be different. They're just meant to be better, which is like, well, how can that not be different? Well, yeah, but it's not like this remastered kind of business where they're trying to change the sound of it, you know? It just sounds like you got a really, really good copy of that record that has hardly any background noise and is very vivid, you know? So it's real.
Yeah, it's not remixed at all. It's the same analog master that they're using, and they're using this one step process. And Chris Bellman, who's a very good mastering engineer, is overseeing it. I mean, Greg Colby, who's a very good mastering engineer, oversaw it originally.
Yeah,
yeah, that's the thing about it. And I think people want these transformations, and the record business kind of sold the idea of that, you know, with all kinds of nonsense like digital mastering and 180 gram vinyl and all that stuff that kind of doesn't mean anything, but this is actually different in a good way.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think they found the original tapes, which I think does make a difference.
Sure.
Those had been sort of not lost, but on some of these other reissues that they haven't had the actual original master.
Yeah.
So
what was each of your experience in hearing this version of it when you probably hadn't listened to the record in a bit?
For me, it was just like, wow, this is a thing that is claimed, you know, to be better that is, you know. So I was delighted. And then of course I played the whole thing and I thought, yeah, this is a mighty good record too. But I mean, the sonic aspect was fun. But I mean, no matter how good it sounds, I'm amazed, not because it doesn't deserve it, but just I'm amazed that this record matters to people after all this time, because so many great things get forgotten. And somehow this one soldiers on as a record that people still play, which is beautiful and inexplicable. But does kind of justify this kind of reissue, right? Because it's still got life in it.
Yeah. How about you, Don?
Same thing. I listened to it on a couple of, like a really super hi-fi system. I listened to it on with really expensive in-ear things. And I listened to it on a regular old stereo, and it's great on all three. And it did sound better. It was quieter. It was, I think, Mitch's word vivid is a perfect example. And, yeah, it was the record we made pretty much, which is, well, not pretty much. I mean, back then that was the best thing we had, you know, the best reproduced thing that you could give someone was an LP. You know, I'm a fan of CDs. I think CDs show you how good a recording is or how shitty one is, you know, and LPs can kind of mask everything. LPs are a bit of a melting pot. And, anyway, this thing sounds really good, and it sounds a lot like the tape we made.
My memory of the CD, when Murmur first came out on CD, my memory was that it sounded really different from the record, and I don't know whether it was mastered differently for CD or what, but there was something different about the Murmur CD, and I don't know whether...
But there's so many things to this, you know, like you're playing, it's not just the digital format. It's the fact that it's going through a whole different machine. You know, the whole CD player is different from a turntable, you know.
Of course.
But it is true that LPs are kind of soft focus compared to the master tape. So I think some of the stuff that people would blame CDs for in its digitalness was sometimes true because it was sort of early digital, but also sometimes true because the record company made it from a safety master, a non-original source. But beyond that, I think everybody was used to the, in other words, I think if people would hear the CDs and hear the master taped, then they would go, oh, so it's really the LP that sounds different. It's not that the CD is messing up the sound, you know? In other words, the CDs really are more like the tape. There's no question. But nobody ever heard the tape, you know, they only ever heard the LP and they like that sound. I mean, a bit of soft focus is nice when looking in the mirror sometimes, you know? So I think that's true for music too sometimes.
I think I might have wondered whether Murmur had been remixed at all when it first was on CD, but maybe
it wasn't. No.
Was there anything you noticed about the, it's kind of like when you read something you wrote long time ago and you're like, oh, I forgot about this, or this struck me more now in retrospect. Was there anything about, you know, Murmur or Chronic Town where going back to him, you thought, oh, you know what? I hadn't really thought about this, but this thing's pretty cool.
not really. You know, I mean, I think we heard it a lot and we remember what we did. And sometimes I hear it again and I think, oh, that's kind of delightful and I'm glad we did that or whatever. But I don't think I have the perspective now to really expound on that very much.
No, I hadn't listened to the record in a really long time when I listened to it. And when I say really long time, it's not really long time, like maybe 10 years. But I was pleasantly surprised how good it was. I mean, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, it was fun, really fun to listen to, and it just flies by.
Yeah. You know, there is one thing I should mention about that. Your experience hearing the Murmur CD that maybe people don't know is that record companies they don't like to send the actual master tape to like other territories, you know, that just so nothing happens to it. And those CDs were made in Japan by JBC, which did a good job, but they would not have gotten the original tapes. They would have gotten Dolby A encoded safety copies, which, you know, are good, but they are analog copies. So they're not going to be identical.
Yeah. So, I think my memory of it is just, it was kind of just a lot brighter than the original.
Well, that's another thing that people just brighten things up. They will,
especially in the early CD era.
Yeah,
but also LPs roll off the top end, which can be merciful. But typically, you lose a certain kind of top end on an LP. You know, again, I don't think that they tweaked it to make it brighter. I think it was sort of anyway. I think it was just sort of what happens. You know.
So, Mitch, what was it like to go back in the studio with Peter Buck and Mike Mills for the last Baseball Project record, Grand Salami Time?
Well, it was funny because I hadn't been in that situation with them in a long time, and it was just sort of eerily the same. You know, I mean, it was familiar. You know, it's like those guys, you know, I know them well enough that being around them years later is sort of like the same as when you're around them every day, you know, which is great, right? You, like, you know what I mean? It wasn't like I had to remember how to talk to them or feel uncomfortable or anything, but the studio vibe with them individually was very much like it was with REM, you know. And you know, Peter, no nonsense, get it done. Okay, I did it. Mike has more to say about everything, but he's also efficient too, you know. And yeah, they're those guys are really the same, you know. That whole session was quite different, but those guys were sort of super familiar in this good way.
Right. And then you got Steve Wynn and Scott McCoy, who've written most of the songs. And then you have Linda Pittman, who's the powerhouse drummer, too. So, and they all seem to get along great. So,
yeah, they're like the kind of band you can have when you're the right kind of grown up, you know, or you're just really just going to, you're just, the official thing is to be agreeable, you know, right? So I don't think they had a lot of, you know what I mean? It's a fun project. That's all it is for them. Just fun, fun, fun. I mean, they wanted it to be good, but the motive was fun, you know, and that was cool because, you know, REM was like young guys trying to get somewhere in show business, but also figure out how to do it and write songs for early on in their lives, you know. So that's all completely different, of course, but merits to both approaches, you know, both. I mean, it's cool to see these people sort of stay good, you know, over a long time, right?
And yeah, and still, and doing it because they love the music, and you know, I've enjoyed the fact that I've been able to see these guys in REM and clubs, and you know, that they're obviously doing it for the love of the music, and not, you know, because they need to be, you know, getting carted around in limousines or something.
They like to play. They're like, you know, they're like Paul McCartney or John Entwistle or these guys that just want to play all the time. You know, yeah. It's kind of cool.
I bet McCartney likes the limos, though.
He probably does, but he sure does like to play all the time.
He does, absolutely. I spent less money seeing the Baseball Project.
Yeah, but you did.
But, I mean, I'm a huge McCartney. I'm a huge McCartney Beatles nut. So, Last thing, just what is each of you working on now?
Well, I'm trying to finish some of my songs. That's what I'm trying to do right now.
Yay!
Good.
And Don Dixon is probably doing that too.
No, I gave up on being an artist long ago.
Oh, please.
When I was 30, I think, is when I realized I was over the hill as an artist. So it's all been down. I really haven't. I wrote a new Christmas song this year. That's about as exciting as my writing has been. And, you know, I have this Christmas band up here in Ohio that just finished our last show last night for the season called the Ohio City Singers. There are 9 of us, and we've recorded 59 original Christmas songs so far.
Wow.
That's pretty powerful.
Yeah. So we started, well, they started before me, but I started with them in 2008.
How's the new one go?
my new song is called Sending My Love, and it's about a guy. It's sort of a 1967 R&B song, and
it's a great era.
I sang it for Marty and asking her if she wanted to put some on, and she's going, "Sending My Love, I want something more than that. What you doing? Just give me your love. I want something. What is this? This is a horrible song." But yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, Roy Wood's Christmas song has done really well for him, and this one might do it for you. I mean,
but what was Roy's Christmas song?
Was it like "I Wish It Could Be Christmas Every Day" or something?
Yeah. Well, that was him. I didn't realize that was him.
That's like sold, you know, like crazy number. You know, it's a national anthem in England kind of thing. You know, it's a staple. You know,
Mitch, when did you start playing Rickenbackers?
Okay, I wanted one when I played one in Charlotte at this music store. Actually, this pawn shop called Reliable Music that was a great music store. But my peers couldn't grasp why I would want that because it was the days of like heavier rock, you know. So I didn't get one, but I remembered how it sounded and how it played. And then many years later, I did some stuff with Richard Barone of the Bongos, and he had a Rickenbacker 330. And it just reminded me of that. And I remember Pete Townsend playing those ones. They're the sort of pointy ones. And I thought,
right,
I'm going to get one, you know? And so I did. And it really wasn't Peter Buck. It was Richard Barone, but I was copying Richard. He reminded me that I liked those guitars. And then I got it and I thought, this thing is weird. It's hard to get anything out of it. You know, it was sort of dead, like, you know, but it made me figure out a way to play it that made me better, I think. So it served me well.
So 330 is what you got.
Yeah. Yeah, I was never a 360 guy. That's what Peter plays. But they're the same, really, but the body's different.
The 330 is pointier.
It's pointier and it's cheaper. You know, the 360 has like a stereo output, which nobody uses, but it's kind of cool.
Right.
And it has the big markers on the neck, you know. But I like the pointy ones, you know, so I got 330.
There's a review in Vinyl Cut of this new package, and it's talking about how great, you know, these records sound. And it says that, you're talking about Chris Bellman has helped breathe new life into these 40-plus-year-old recordings. That's obvious from the first ringing notes of guitarist Peter Buck's 12-string Rickenbacker on Wolves Lower. And I'm like, that's nope, a 6-string. Nope, that's nope. Not a 12-string.
Oh, give me a break. That is obviously not a 12-string.
Yeah.
So, and if it was a 12 string, it would have been my Fender 12 string, which is on the REM records, but not on that song.
Oh, so when there's a 12 string, it's your Fender. Is that a Telecaster?
No, it was the Fender dedicated electric 12 string that they made for a long time called the Electric 12. And it was, you know, XII. It's a wonderful guitar. And actually it's an unsung 12 string, but it's actually the 12 string on a lot of Who songs, and it's the 12 string on Stairway to Heaven. And, you know, it's kind of, it's the one that Roy Wood played on Hello Susie, for example, is the Fender.
Really?
And I had one. And so, I think I did say to Peter, because, you know, I like guitar textures. And I think I said to Peter, you might want to try this on something. And so it appears on their records. And then he got his own, Rickenbacker one in time for, Reckoning, but the Murmur 12 is all the Fender. Actually,
I'm trying to think what's on the 12 on Murmur.
It's just some doubled stuff, really. It's
I can't think offhand, but it's all over the place. Actually,
all right.
But yeah, well, Wolves. That's definitely Peter's.
That's Peter's a six
guitar.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So
12.
Six. Well, thank you so much for letting me nerd out with you guys. I really appreciate it. Great talking to you guys.
See you, miss.
Same to you. Thanks a lot.
That's all for episode 208 of Caropop. Thanks so much to Mitch Easter and Don Dixon for taking us back into the studio with early REM and opening our ears to so many cool details about those recordings. I loved those albums then, and they sound just as powerful today. The Chronicktown Murmur Definitive Series One Step can be bought at Interscope.com for $124.98. It's a numbered limited edition release of 3,000 copies, and the webpage says almost gone. You can hire Easter to record and produce your band at his Fidelatorium Recording Studio in North Carolina between Winston-Salem and Greensboro. Dixon keeps a low profile in his Ohio home, but as his muscular production of Peter Holsapple's The Face of 68 shows, he's still got it. Caropop is produced by Chris Swake, who loves it when we talk about the passion. Thanks to all who support Caropop. If you'd like to throw something into the Caropop kitty, we'd be much appreciative, and I'll give you a shout out on the next episode. You can give $24 or whatever you'd like at caropop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Caropop on the so-called socials at Caropopcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro at MARKCARO. Please share this episode, subscribe here and on YouTube, tell your friends, and return next week for another Caro Pop Conversation. Thanks.